You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Chartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 392 of the podcast. First of all, let me just start off by thanking people who came out last night to Brick, this wonderful arts and media resource center. These are the guys that, among many other things, oversee Celebrate Brooklyn, which is that wonderful summer outdoor music festival in Prospect Park at the Band Show. So they oversee that. They used to be called BCAT stations, but these free speech channels that are on Brooklyn community channels are also overseen by Brooklyn. And then they also have a high definition channel that they program. It's called Brick TV. And I've been on, you know, this daily live show a bunch of times called BK Live. And anyway, but Brick overall has a series that they a series they do once a month called Brick Flicks. And each month they do an event. They invite someone to run an event about something, some different aspect of film. And I was invited to do an event, and last night I did it. I mentioned it on the last episode, and it was a great success. I really had a great time. We had a nice turnout. I just want to thank everybody who did come out, who might be listening, for coming out to that. We did it on the subject of film restoration and film preservation, and joining me was Ben Crossley Mara from Janus Films, Katie Trainer from the Museum of Modern Art Preservation and Restoration Department, and from the Cineric Laboratory, restorer technician Simon Lund, all came, and we had a great engaged crowd, and it was just a delight. And so I want to thank everybody at Brick and all those who did come to the show, and my great panelists as well. I will be streaming the audio from that on a special episode of the podcast in the next few weeks. So if you're interested in hearing that, you'll have the opportunity to do so. Anyway, that was terrific. The next thing coming up, if you want to run into me anyway, not that I'm suggesting you go out of the way to do so. I mean, if you're a listener and you enjoy the podcast and you're interested and you live locally in New York, I'm just mentioning things that I'm involved with for what they're worth. But the next thing is starting this weekend at MoMA, or the Museum of Modern Art, is a festival called Doc Fortnite. And it's an annual festival of documentaries that have not been distributed as of yet anyway. And they tend to gravitate towards a more experimental or artful side. They're not as mainstream. Anyway, I participated in one. It's called Tip of My Tongue. It was directed by Lynn Sachs, who is a wonderful filmmaker. If you get a chance to catch her documentary, Your Day is My Night, I recommend it highly. Anyway, she made this film again. It's called Tip of My Tongue. I participated in it. If you're around, if you want to come out, they're having a screening. It's the closing night film for Doc Fortnite, and they're going to have one screening on Saturday night, February the 25th at 7:30. I'll be there for that. And then again, the next day on Sunday, the 26th at 5 o'clock, there's going to be a second screening of Tip of My Tongue. And I should be there for that as well. And I will have friends and family members coming. And, you know, if you're interested, Google Doc Fortnite or tip of my tongue, and I'm sure it'll come up. Now, Lynn is also just a terrific filmmaker, as I mentioned. She's also happens to be, you know, in this very, like, her whole, all the relationships that she has seems to be family filmmakers. Now, you know, a few shows back, I had on Kirsten Johnson, the director of Camera Person. Well, there's a connection there. Lynn, who just happens to be also married to a filmmaker named Mark Street, and the two of them were both on episode number 328 of the podcast, if you want to go and hear that, Lynn and Mark. But the connection to Kirsten, that Lynn's brother is Ira Sachs, and Ira, too, has been on the podcast several times, or at least on two occasions. Episode number 57, where he talked about his film Keep the Lights On, and then again on episode number 234, where he talks about Love is Strange. And I've been pursuing getting Ira back on again. Anyway, Lynn is the sister of Ira. Ira is shares a twin children. He is the father, although he's married to his husband for some time. They co-parent with Kirsten of these twin children. If you listen to Ira, I think he talks a little bit about it on the earlier visit, and then Kirsten does talk about it too on her episode. So this is, of course, the niece and nephew of Lynn Sachs. And that is, so I've had all these people on the show, so you can get quite a bit of background about this an interesting family of filmmakers and storytellers. Anyway, long story short, Lynn Sachs will be there. I'm sure Mark will be there. Ira will be there Saturday, the 25th of February. It's coming right up. Tickets are available on the Doc Fortnite page on the MoMA website. So go get some tickets and join me and everybody else from the film. It looks like it's a really good film. You know, I haven't seen it, but that's all coming up next. And I'm going to be doing a little bit of promotion of that, even though I didn't have anything. It's not a FilmWax related production. I just happened to be involved in the film. You want to read the synopsis. It's essentially she gets a group of very different people together who are all recently turned 50. I don't know why I was involved. I'm just such a young lad in my 20s, but who knows? Anyhow, and we all discuss what it is to be at this point of our lives and about memory and all these other things. And then she basically made this very artful film from those moments. If you do Google it, you can look at the trailer and decide if you want to come out. On with this particular episode, thank you for putting up with and humoring me for the last 10 minutes. This episode, a very special episode. Speaking of Brick, I am someone who is still very much, invested in the local Brooklyn and New York filmmaking community. So while I may have on big time folks like Barbara Koppel, who I sat down with today, I still also want to continue to, you know, champion the community of those who are doing God's work, shall we say, who are out there programming and filmmaking for the pure passion of it. Not to say they don't have a desire to make a good living at it, but they do it because they love film and they love connecting with audiences. So I have two ladies coming on the show in the first segment. Melissa Lide, who programs her own film series, much like talking to her, I felt like this is when I was doing a film series. I felt very connected in the way she was talking about her series, which is called Alfreda's Cinema. And it's a pretty much a monthly a film series that takes place at Videology in Williamsburg. You can find it on Facebook or just Google Alfreda's Cinema. It's interesting because a number of recent screenings lined up with some of my past guests, like Lizzie Borden, when she had on Born in Flames and Charles Burnett with Killer Sheep. They just sort of coincided, so it was kind of interesting. So I wanted to make sure I posted this conversation with Melissa and this filmmaker named Jatavia Gary, who is a terrific filmmaker in her own right. But I wanted to post this segment because there is another event coming up, another screening event of Alfreda's Cinema. on February the 27th, and it's called Seven Songs for Malcolm X. And again, it's going to be at Videology Bar and Cinema, which is located at 308 Bedford Avenue, which is at the corner of South 3rd. And I guess you could also go to Videology's website, but that's coming up in a week from Monday. And I will try to get out there for that as well. And then, as I mentioned, joining Melissa is filmmaker Jatavia Gary. You can visit her website, Jatavia.com. That's Jatovia.com if you're interested and check out her work and what she's up to after you listen to the segment with Melissa and Jatavia. It was a lot of fun. We had a really nice time, I must say. After that, we're going to have a great conversation with the author, Noah Eisenberg, who is a neighbor of mine and also in Brooklyn, and has written a book on the 75th anniversary of Casablanca, the classic of maybe one of the favorite films ever made. And he has written a book called We'll Always Have Casablanca, which is published by Norton Press and currently available as of just the other day. So I highly recommend it. It was a fun read for any film lover. This is a must. And I was glad to have the occasion to meet and talk with this terrific author and film lover and academic. So we're going to go right now into my conversation with film programmer Melissa Lide and filmmaker Jatavia Gary. So welcome to the podcast. Let me do a proper introductions here, since I get really good after this part, but I really suck at doing these formal, conventional types of intros. Now, Melissa, you are let's go down the list of things, and I don't know which parts you want to mention and you don't want to emphasize necessarily, but the main thing that we want to talk about, of course, is that you curate this film series called Alfreda's Cinema, mm-hmm. right? Which is it monthly or is it?
It's been monthly as of late, actually. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which just means that I'm engaging in it more. I want to mm-hmm. pay for the licensing fees more and just be a part of, I guess, showing the films that I want to see. I'm inspired.
Mm-hmm. You show some really good ones, too.
Yeah, some good ones.
We've had a little bit of a synchronicity, right? We've been a little syncopated because you showed, for one thing, you showed Killer of Sheep recently, and I had just interviewed Charles Burnett, right? And then Born in Flames, and I had on Lizzie Borden just recently. And so is underground stuff your favorite? Is that or your favorite to show?
Well, I'm definitely more interested in like art, cinema, and but with mm-hmm. of course, with the story focusing on people of color. And just the cast really being a very diverse cast. I'm so into like just independent films per se and foreign films. So mm-hmm. I try and keep it as focused in that genre as much as possible.
Well, you're certainly achieving that, at least what I can tell. Not to be rude, we're also joined today by a filmmaker, Jatavia Gary.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for
you nailed it that time, Jatavia Gary.
Okay. Thank you for coming out. And I guess I saw one short that you created. What was it called again? It was called like
An Ecstatic Experience.
An Ecstatic Experience. And it was repurposing existing film clips from, I know one thing was a Ruby Dee performance, which.
Yes.
Right. Was that was from which play?
This is actually from an hour long television special that aired in, I want to say, 1960.
She was so young.
Five. It may have been 65, in somewhere between 65 and 68. And it starred her and her husband, Ozzie Davis. And they are performing these monologues that were culled from slave narratives. And there's also...
Diary entries or...
Whoever wrote this was pulling from slave narratives. Yeah.
Okay.
And so there's also a chorus singing as well. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of the main footage in the film. But there's also an interview with Asada Shakur in the film. There is footage from a church service from the American South, from North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And there is Baltimore uprising footage. So I've placed all of these seemingly disparate elements together into one film.
Mm-hmm. And were you able to show that in any?
Yeah, the film has been to a number of festivals. Most recently, the Edinburgh Film Festival. Mm-hmm. It won a special jury prize at the New Orleans Film Festival this summer.
That's great work.
And it played at the Whitney most recently. They had a special screening series all throughout December and January. So it played alongside some really amazing avant-garde filmmakers, Kevin Jerome Everson, Stephanie Jemison, Deani Dews. It's been to about, I want to say maybe 20 festivals and a couple of museums. It was at
MoCA
and Hammer.
Certainly, yeah, I could see that. It lends itself, for sure. I've participated in this documentary. It's going to be at part of the Doc Fortnight at MoMA. Do you know Lynn Sachs? Do you know her work?
Lynn Sachs, experimental filmmaker.
Yeah. And her husband, Mark Street, is also an experimental filmmaker, too. They're, I guess, you know, one of those rare experimental filmmaker power couples.
Very rare.
If there can be such a thing. So, and where did you grow up?
I'm originally from Dallas, Texas. I'm Southern.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been, I know, by the grace of God, but I've been in New York. I've been in New York for about 15 years.
That's
for
long.
A while, so you can't even hear the Southern anymore unless I get really upset or really drunk. But I grew up in Dallas, Texas, a suburb outside of Dallas, Cedar Hill.
Mm-hmm. So I would say you're a New Yorker. And Melissa, you grew up here?
Yeah, I'm born and raised in Brooklyn.
Yeah, that's why
I feel like everyone from Brooklyn says born and raised.
That's awesome.
Yeah. There should be a term. BR in the BK, whatever it is.
All the way.
Okay, and you're working at Film Movement.
Yeah, I also work at Film Movement in an administrative capacity, but and I'm starting to help develop more of their social exchange.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's been great. I've been with them for about a year now.
I must have met you then pretty early on.
Yeah, pretty much like the first month I think I was working there.
Okay. Now when anybody walks in, you don't even like look up. But did you, when you say social exchange, I'm just curious, is that something to do with...
social media.
It is social media? Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. They have a kind of a big part of what they do is educational distribution, right? I mean, institutional sort of screenings and that kind of thing.
It's funny because even though a lot of people know them as like having a film club, I mean, it's just like any other film distribution company.
Yeah.
I think we're trying to focus more on our theatrical distribution.
Right. No, and as you're seeing it more and more. I've noticed more Film Movement titles coming up in my purview anyway. I don't know.
We've been getting a lot of films, and last year we had an Oscar.
I forgot about
contender.
The film club.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that was, now that you mentioned it, I do remember that part of the business was probably kind of more popular at one point.
Mm-hmm.
When people
were watching DVDs.
Yeah, and all that.
Even though I do, I love DVDs.
Yeah,
I still watch them all the time.
Yeah. I just, in fact, restarted getting Netflix DVDs. Because I, you know, if I'm looking for to see like more popular titles that I've missed, it's like, you know, an easy way just to get them. Like, because they're not streaming those titles, you know.
That's one of the ways they get you. It's by offering them more popular films on DVD.
Yeah. Well, they got me. So it's a small fee, so I'm okay with it. You know, I get so much free subscriptions to all these streaming services, like, you know, that
I'm sure you get to talk about them and people want to hear from you.
Yeah.
You should share your login with us.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Its username is Ashartoff. Yes. Well, I don't know how some of these businesses, you know, I don't know who, you know, how they survive or flourish because, Filmstruck, I think I think that might have more, it's a little sexier to the.
Yeah, you know, but they also have to get their Turner Classic Movies audience into the streaming realm. And, you know, I mean, from the calls that I take at Film Movement, the older viewership, wiser viewership, I usually like to say, I don't know, they always say, I'm not technical. I don't know how to adjust. But I think that'll be like their main, that should be like a focus, but I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about it, like another 20 years and the old people will have already been acclimated to technology and streaming and all that, right? So, like maybe another 20 years, maybe, like till we don't have that conversation anymore, don't you? But there'll be another level of technology that everybody's uncomfortable with, right? Like VR and whatever.
It will just continue, yeah, like to expand, the technology will. And then those people will unfortunately perish and it will be us who will be struggling with the new technology, maybe. I don't know. You should edit that as well.
It's going to be a very short segment at this rate if we keep this up.
Sorry, I'm a control freak.
I mean, I'm just still kind of like...
I know, you said questions.
I didn't say questions.
Oh, I thought you did.
Melissa said questions.
Oh, I got it wrong. I do want to talk about there were some
she
great.
She asked me for the question. Okay. She did ask me for questions.
Makes sense.
No, seriously, first of all, I didn't know how. But this is my first podcast experience.
Congratulations!
And I did not know how this happened. I didn't send the questions at him. Okay.
Well, no, I appreciate it. I just wanted to, like, nobody knows before they do it. A lot of people don't know. Oh, this is the way the experience is going to play out. But like, I actually thought it would. I welcome people's like talking points, because that means I'll make sure to include their things they care about and they want to talk about. So that's great. I just wanted to make it clear also, though, okay, just so you know, this is really unscripted. Well, not like you can't tell already, but this is now a very superfluous thing to say, but this is the least scripted type of show you'll ever get to. But somehow or other, I always manage to get those important things in there, you know, somehow or other. And then I also do like an intro, and I'm always reinforcing screening times and locations and or whatever it is that you're hawking. But it's nice because then you don't have to feel like you have to hawk too hard either.
And I have nothing to hawk.
So you don't have any other...
I mean, I'm working on something, but I'm not keen on, you know, going into
you don't have to
too much detail.
Promote it right now.
Yeah. No.
So it's...
Yeah, find me out there. Find me on the interwebs or whatever.
How do people, since you brought it up?
I have a website. Mm-hmm. It's my name, Jatovia, jatovia.com.
Oh, you don't even, you just can go by that first name.
When
That's
you have
great.
A strange name, you can just pull, you know, you got dibs. And, you know, Facebook or Twitter, I don't know, you know. I'm not too big into a certain amount of visibility just yet. I'm still trying to work out, you know, my work and my voice and what I'm saying. So sometimes it's best to do that while you are, you know, you still have a bit of anonymity. But, you know, we live in the information age. You can find me and my work wherever.
It's just a Google search away, right? Always, right? Yeah. Well, you know, while we're, I think I was talking a little bit with Melissa before a little bit about this, you know, I get these comments on iTunes. There aren't too many. I wish more people, if you're listening, for God's sake, please. I'm always hawking. If you're subscribing on iTunes, the least you could do is spend a few seconds going on there and leaving a comment and a star rating. It helps, because eventually more people will trip upon this podcast that way. But there are comments, and I remember reading there, and all of them were like glowing. Because, you know, the people that are writing it are part of the choir. So they're all saying, Adam's a genius. Adam is the most brilliant. And I'm just saying, oh, please. And then I get to one and it says, great show. I wish Adam, though, had more segments dealing with the films and the filmmakers of color.
That's a good critique.
It is. I know. I don't. I deleted it, but I still believe. No, I'm kidding around. Of course, you can't do that.
No.
No, I wish I had had the. I wish those comments, constructive comments, because it was not only said, it was couched really sense, like in a sensitive way. It wasn't like, you suck, you know, you're a racist or something. I mean, you know, that would probably have been.
Do you need it to be couched in a sensitive way, Adam?
Yes.
Okay.
I do. I need a lot of coddling. No, but it was very helpful. I'm like, this is good. This is important because, first of all, for obvious reasons, it should matter to me. And then secondly, Brooklyn and New York alone is a diverse group of artists and filmmakers and storytellers. And I think my podcast, even though it goes beyond those borders, I do want it to reflect that community, you know. And also, I think that what I see is still a kind of a bit of a segregation that it's not terrible, but it's not great. I'm probably looking at things as optimistically as I can. But, you know, I go to a lot of events and there seems to be, you know, quite a majority of white people at most of the events, and then other types of events, maybe there's more diversity or there's more people of color and fewer white. I don't know. But so I kind of think, well, the show can at least do a good job. At least I know I can, because I not only do the show, but I also book it, so I can do a better job. So that's been one of the things I'm concerned about. And when I, you know, want to, so that's my point. And so I guess I'm opening it up a little bit to that. And you know, your Alfredo Cinema, I know, it does a good job of having a diverse, at least, even though you don't have the filmmakers there.
Not often.
But sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes I've had them present.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I just guess I felt like I wasn't seeing, you know, myself out there.
Yeah.
As far as you know, people like me, not just the way I look, but my taste in films, and so I was just like, well, you know, I could do it. So that was kind of just my thinking, and yeah, it's worked out.
Mm-hmm. And you screen at Videology.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been supportive, obviously.
Yeah, they have. Every time I feel like quitting, I get an email
from Austin, or
for Austin, and uh-huh. He's like, "So, what do you have up for this month?" And just
he's taking you for granted, which is nice.
Is he? I don't
well, I mean it in a, like he's
yeah.
That's he's, the way he's couching it. Like, is. Well, we're doing another screening, you know. I'm just,
yeah,
so
he
what
always,
is it going to be?
Yeah.
It's not like, do you want to do another one?
Yeah, no, yeah. For sure. And I appreciate that. I mean, I don't even think that's his intention ever, but he's just like, okay, what's next, you know, on the docket? And just when, you know, I feel like I've had enough, I get that email. I'm like, okay, I did just see a movie that I really do want to watch, like with a community of people. So why not?
Mm-hmm.
That's how I go after it.
And do you ever contact filmmakers who are outside of the New York area and ask them, or maybe even just the city, and ask them to travel?
Well, actually, my first screening there, a friend who I went to college with had a film that I really wanted to screen, and I didn't even realize he lived in Jersey, but... then I asked him to come. I actually asked all of the filmmakers to come. One girl came from Atlanta, and I was like, wow.
Yikes.
Yeah, thanks for coming. It's, you know, just in the back of a bar. But, yeah, come through. So that was my first screening, and we had a great turnout, and all the filmmakers came. But since I've been showing, like, more international films, I mean, it's kind of difficult and older
sure.
titles, so...
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to see more filmmakers here locally. Someone I do have in mind hopefully can come. I did have Keith Miller, who did mm-hmm. Five Star. I pretty much kind of stalked him. And
he's a real friend of the podcast.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's been on like
he's great.
Five times, I think.
Oh, cool.
I haven't even invited him the last couple of times.
And then... yeah, another gentleman, his name is Kalika Law.
Oh, sure.
Who did Phil Niggas. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool.
I had him on, actually, what was the name of the film again?
Phil Niggas.
That's right. How easy to forget. Field niggas. Anyway, so that, actually, it's funny because that film had, well, he just had it on YouTube at mm-hmm. that point. Somebody brought it to my attention, Ralph Scott. Do you know Ralph? And he was doing a series at RealWorks, which is this, you know, organization in Brooklyn that teaches film to high schoolers. I was brought to my town. I interviewed him on the podcast. And then the next thing I know, he's like being invited out to True False and Rooftop Films. But he was one of the sweetest guys. And now he doesn't return my emails, but that's okay. He has a new film.
Yeah, he's worked on a new film.
He's an incredible talent.
Yeah, yeah. I think I actually just was introduced to his work through his photography.
Yeah.
And then I researched him, and then I saw the teaser for Field Niggas, and I was like, wow. And then I just had to get it. Yeah.
I was surprised him like that. Because he didn't know way back like what the process was. He was a photographer and street photographer, and you know, he's all of a sudden made this art, this work, and you know, didn't have much guidance at the very, very beginning, you know, but he quickly got it, and he you know, he's a good guy. So I'm sure by now he knows.
Yeah.
He's learned a lot, I'm sure.
Yeah, we've become friends from that. Mm-hmm. So
did you show Field Niggas that part of your,
yeah,
was that your first screening? Is that what you said?
No, okay. Actually the film, yeah, I'm not gonna try to remember the title. So
how many have you done roughly?
I've had about, well, it's been 2 years, so mm-hmm. let's say just under 20.
Okay.
Under 20 screenings. I'm going to say like 18.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this February 27th is the 19th one, possibly.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah.
So February 27th is the
27th, next one. 27th,
yeah, is the next one. We'll, what's today, the 11th or something?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sure we can get this up before then. So go to Videology Bedford and South 3rd, I think it's on, right? South 3rd Street? I don't remember
South
the address.
Yeah, South 3rd in Bedford. 308 Bedford Avenue.
308. Yeah, there was talk of trying to do live podcasts there. I've done a couple. And, you know, trying to do something regular there, but it's just so much work. So I just haven't gotten around to doing something to regular at Videology, too. Yeah.
It's a cool space. It's pretty fun. Mm-hmm. I think just the fact that they have, you know, booze is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have to worry about refreshments and you know,
right.
It's already there and I could just show the film and, you know, pop in, pop out. Done. Done. No cleaning necessary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And so how did you guys, Jatavi, how did you guys meet?
I kind of forget. Do you remember? Was it? It was at a screening. Was it?
No, I thought, I think we went to the Luminal Theater opening.
Oh, yeah.
It was, I'm calling that a screening because
Curtis
John, yeah. He's an amazing human. He's great, isn't he?
If you can get him when he's not running, then you're lucky because apparently, from what I can see on social media, he's always running.
He's running marathons or training for a marathon.
Always
like,
running.
He lives around the way from me.
Yes.
And so I'm like, oh my God, Curtis, how are you?
Yeah.
But he had an opening for a pop-up theater that mm-hmm. was a couple of summers back,
mm-hmm.
and it was the Luminal Theater. Mm-hmm. And I was there with my friend Stephanie, and you were there, and we had a conversation about film, and we were telling you about our work and saying, oh, we'll get in contact with you, and la, 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 mm-hmm. la. So I think you may have screened Cakes to Killa, or did you screen Ecstatic first?
Yeah, I screened Ecstatic. I need to get to Cakes to Killa, actually.
What's
since
that?
You just...
That's a...
Oh, you know that.
No.
That's my... Cakes to Killa is a film that I did before in Ecstatic. Cakes to Killa is a queer rapper. He's a rapper who is gay.
Okay.
And he's amazing. He's a really strong talent, intense talent. And I made this film when I was in grad school. Mm. I went to SVA.
Mm-hmm.
So this was like a...
thesis project, in a sense?
No, not even that thesis. It was mm-hmm. like the first year, I feel like. It may have been second semester, first year. But it was a pretty strong work. It was the work that, you know, kind of the first piece of work that I was... proud of, and it was like a portrait of him and his amazing, you know, performances.
Mm.
So yeah, that's that. And yeah, you should show it because it's Papa, and I love that film. Even though sometimes I cringe when I watch it because it's such, you know, early work. You know, mm-hmm. when you look back on early work, you're like, oh my God, you know, what was I doing? You know, the sound is.
I'd like to see it though.
Yeah.
Did you ever study under Manny Kirchheimer?
No, I was part of the Sock Doc. So social documentary, the MFA program that they have. Mm-hmm. Who is there? Tom Hurwitz is there. Michelle Negroponte.
Michelle is a good friend.
Yeah, he's awesome. He's like,
I know, he's a lovely guy, right? You should listen to that episode. Well, he's been on twice, and I have a segment ready to go with a third episode with Michelle. I have friends of these people that just keep coming back on. I love that part of doing the show because it kind of comes this creates kind of a community of people that are regulars on the podcast, and really what it takes is more just their desire to keep coming back, and also just a congeniality, But Manny, Manfred Kirchheimer, who is he's a venerable filmmaker, but I went to his apartment a year or two ago and did a long conversation with him, but they just are finishing today. Actually, is the last day of this retrospective at MoMA
Deserved. Saw an email and I missed out. And I wanted to get.
Yeah, me too. I meant to promote it, and I did. I can't believe I just let the ball drop. But I'm sure they did okay without me. I wanted to say about Michelle also that at Doc NYC there was this documentary. It's about this.
Was it Michelle's doc?
No, that was the year before. He had the one about
Michelle Marin,
who did the podcast with him. Michelle and Michelle did the podcast together. We went out to her apartment.
Wow.
That's another story. And the filmmaker herself suffered from this. But point is that she follows this woman in the documentary who is bipolar. And so I had the filmmaker, Rebbe Ratner, on the show, and I said, Michelle Negroponte, I said, you should join in the conversation. And he said, I saw it, and it's incredible. So the three of us have this incredible conversation. It's really intense. And that one I haven't put up yet, but it's like an hour and a half conversation. Yeah, it's really good.
Listen, Michelle Negroponte is the bomb.
Just hold it a little closer. Yeah, go ahead. He's the bomb.
Yeah, he is the bomb because I had grad school can be rough and MFAs can be a difficult space. You're learning about yourself and you're trying to figure out your voice. And it was hard for me at SVA. There were some people who were great, but it was still, kind of a tough climb. But Michelle was really instrumental in getting me to think beyond the instruction that I was getting within the classroom, but to also kind of go out and really do some deep dives into avant-garde work and experimental work that I had not had any, knowledge of. And it expanded my visual vocabulary in such a tremendous way. Mm-hmm. I still hit up Michelle and I'm like, can you take a look at this and let me know what you're thinking? Or I'm thinking about, taking the film this way. And he will just kind of fire off titles, for me to go watch.
He's an historian.
It's helpful.
Yeah.
And the feature that I'm working on now that I was like, oh, I don't want to talk about, which I'm going to talk about.
It's a feature.
Right, yeah, it's a feature autobiographical documentary, which explores relationships, like the intimate spaces between Black people, our families, romantic spaces. I'm looking at myself via my relationships. So I've interviewed almost everybody that I've had a really intense, mom, dad, that type of foundational relationship, former lovers, former boyfriends, siblings. But we're focused a lot on the interior space, right? So the psychological landscape, the emotional space, and even, things surrounding mental health, which has an extreme taboo in not just, society, but, black American society, Black folks' families. So we're shining a light on some of this stuff. And, having these conversations with Michelle and also looking at the work that he has made himself, but also the work that he is kind of, pushed me to experience has been really instrumental in the film that I'm making now, so I feel like I owe him a bit of gratitude for that.
Yeah.
That was long-winded.
Yeah, no. It's nice to hear that. It's nice to...
He's a good
champion. I'll make sure you two also win that show when I post it. I think I was waiting for some sort of tie-in. But, eventually I just post it because, it's really just, another bit of confessional stuff. I was saying also to Melissa earlier that just by way of the show, it's very easy because of the sheer number of white male filmmakers in this town that I could, you know, just to continue booking one after another. And I think I went through periods of it, and I'm all of a sudden I think about, I'm like, you know, this isn't good. I need to kind of do a better job of it. So it takes some conscious effort on my part. And then all of a sudden it seemed like, oh, okay, I feel like I'm doing a better job again. But it doesn't, it's like the easy to gravitate back, it seems like, if I don't make that effort.
Yeah, I can understand how that would be. You know, everybody kind of lives in their space, you mm-hmm. know, and these,
right.
you know, the film community in many ways, it can be homogenous depending on how you're positioned, you know, within it. But, you know, that's why we're here. I can list off about off the top of the dome, like 10 or 15 black women filmmakers, mm-hmm. you know, and that's such a small group of people in the grand scheme of things. But, you know, from where I'm sitting, I'm surrounded by them, you know.
Sure.
I'd say the same thing about programmers, black programmers.
Right.
And just, you know, how many of them of, you know, of color who I look to and I'm inspired by. It's like, you know, you have the creative director of TIFF, Cameron Bailey.
Oh, Cameron Bailey.
Yeah, I'm so inspired by him.
Yeah.
He seems,
I haven't had him on yet.
One day, I'm sure. But,
yeah.
He seems like, I met him and I was just like, Cameron, I'm so inspired by you and I just love what you've done with TIFF. And I mentioned, I was just like, yeah, there are so many good filmmakers here in Brooklyn. And, but it was just one of those moments because for me, because I had just started this venture in programming and I was kind of, I wasn't really looking for other black programmers doing what I do. I was just looking for programmers and I found him and he had such a wonderful festival as well as theater. And I was just kind of following his path a year before I got a chance to kind of just introduce myself to him really. So yeah. And then, you know, you have the Mace Lee's Theater.
Oh, right.
And then, Ashley Clark.
That's great.
Yeah.
Ashley's really on point, right? He's not joking around.
Yeah. I think every time I see him, I pretty much make a fool of myself, but I mean, just what he did with a Black Star. It's so profound. And yeah, it's like, we're out there. We're here.
And also black film festivals, you know,
yeah.
Because you mentioned Black Star, Ashley's program, but there's a Black Star Film Festival in Philadelphia that's ran by Mayori Holmes, a black woman. And she's just done an amazing job. I want to say in the span of 4 or 5 years, it's become this kind of, you know, pivotal happening mm-hmm. that goes on in the summertime in Philadelphia. People, you know, they get there in droves. I've gone twice. Mm-hmm. It's like a family reunion. It's mm-hmm. it's so amazing. And then they'll have like Arthur Jaffa give a talk, you know, or Haile Jerima will be there or mm-hmm. Julie, you know, so they'll bring, so they'll just bring like these amazing people who, you know, no one thought that they would have the opportunity to sit in the room and hear and speak. And it's just so accessible. And then this amazing cross-section of work as well.
Miss Dash is apparently coming to the Queens World Film Festival.
She's going
to
be honored.
They're doing a screen. And they're doing a screening at the Museum of the Moving Image, I think.
Yeah, I'm a bit obsessed with her. Yeah, mm-hmm. she's quite good. Her and
I'm hoping to talk to her.
Yeah, that would be awesome to get her on the show.
Yeah,
The late great Kathleen Collins is mm-hmm. someone I've been obsessing about as well. She directed and wrote Losing Ground, which I saw like a year ago or a year and a half ago at Tell It Like It Is. Michelle Mater, another black woman programmer, she does this creatively speaking film screening series, but she also does some amazing work. So she did Tell It Like It Is at the Lincoln Film Center, and she's also instrumental in this black women's screening series that's happening at BAM right now. I saw Kathleen Collins's work there for the first time, and it just kind of blew the top of my head off. Mm-hmm. It's called Losing Ground, and there's been some screenings recently of, I think that would be great. And I had the really serious privilege of screening Ecstatic right before Losing Ground recently at this film residency at the Jacob Burns Film Center, because it's loosely not inspired by it, but yes, inspired in some ways. It kind of sparked the idea for the film in a interesting way. Podcasts are so weird. Sorry.
It is. Jatavia.com.
Yes, Jatavia.com.
Or you can Google Jatavia. And Alfred, how do people find what's going on with Alfreda's Cinema?
I feel like I'm stronger on Facebook at the moment. Mm-hmm. There's so many streams, you know, out there to find it, but Facebook and Instagram are like my main ways to communicate the screenings. And then also Videology, you can go their website and just find
get on their newsletter.
Yeah, exactly. I'm always posting on Screen Slate too. But that's kind of last minute the way that they email it, but it's always up there. But yeah, mainly my Facebook page, Alfreda Cinema on Facebook.
Thank you guys. This has been a lot of fun, actually. I mean, I'm so excited. I'm glad we did this finally. So
yeah,
come back on. I mean,
I'd love to come back once I'm ready to speak more about the feature once that comes out.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to. I'm looking forward to that. And you know, love to see it when it's when you're ready with it. Sounds intense and really good. So congratulations.
And then when I finally make my film, since that's also something I'm trying to do as well, maybe we can talk about that. But
for sure,
just love
you're always welcome on Film Wax Radio, both of you.
Thank you, Adam. That's very sweet of you.
You know, somehow, I mean, you know, unless someone, I can't imagine what it would take not to be invited back. But sort of my part of my, if there is a credo or some sort of, I don't know, mission statement, mission would be that it would be bringing, once you're invited on, you can always rely on, you know, what I do. Because I also just like, if when I have the time, I'm always posting like, this is coming out and this person's trying to raise money and this is, you know, for anybody who's ever been on. So can you imagine it after it accumulates to the degree where you have like hundreds and hundreds of guests, it gets to be quite a bit. But it's, you know, it's just a matter of
especially
if they actually reach out, that's helpful too, because then, you know, it's easier to know. It's easier to keep track of. Well, thanks again for you guys coming on the show, rather, and I look forward to running into you regularly.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll be seeing each other.
I hope so.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And once again, my conversation with Noah Eisenberg, great author. Again, this book is called We'll Always Have Casablanca, and it's really the backstory behind the making of this film from soup to nuts. I just want to say that it's also a very timely conversation in Trump's America, because many of the cast members, the entire cast was made up of immigrants. And many were refugees, in a sense, as well, escaping Nazi Germany or other areas of oppression. And so I think this film and the conversation in the book are all extremely timely. So I'm really excited for you to hear my conversation with the author, Noah Eisenberg.
Casablanca, city of hope and despair. Located in French Morocco in North Africa, the meeting place of adventurers, fugitives, criminals, refugees lured into this danger-swept oasis by the hope of escape to the Americas. But they're all trapped, for there is no escape. Against this fascinating background is woven the story of an imperishable love and the enthralling saga of six desperate people, each in Casablanca to keep an appointment with destiny.
I was willing to shoot Captain Renault, and I'm willing to shoot you.
All right, Major, you asked for it.
The corrections,
I was working still at Sony Music, where I was for 10 years, and I was going to go to the book, to an author signing of his. And he just kind of had come off of this thing where, you know, they put the Oprah Club stickers on all his books, and he objected to it. And then they had to do another. And so I have an Oprah book copy.
Ah, there you go.
As well as. But anyway, I was going to go from work to the signing because I was really excited to meet him and to, you know. And I grabbed it. And then I said, you know, I'm just going to grab, because you have so much music sitting around, I'm just going to grab this Johnny Cash collection. I think he would like that. Just if I just gave it to him. Because it was all free, this stuff. I had much swag, you know. And I get there and I'm in line. And I give it to him, and he bolts up right. He goes, and he gives me a warm, like, you know, handshake. And so he really, it was the right thing. But I never was able to parlay it, like, go in another time and say, I asked the guy that gave you the Johnny Cash collection.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
It's funny, my wife was at McDowell Colony with him.
What?
At the McDowell Colony. That's that artist, writer's artist.
Yes. Yeah. And is that the one in Iowa or something?
It's up in New
Hampshire?
New Hampshire.
Okay. Yeah.
They were together for a month, so she knows him quite well. But
right.
In fact, it was when he was finishing the corrections.
Oh.
So I have an old galley copy that he'd sent to her, and I'm one of those people that, you know, if there's just too much hype, I tend not to...
A little skeptical.
Yeah, exactly.
More skeptical.
So for whatever reason, it's sort of a teenage rebellious impulse on my part. I'm not proud of it, but I had never read it, and now I realize what I've been missing is I really should have read it then. But anyway.
Yeah.
Well, better late than never, as they say.
Yeah. Do you feel compelled to keep up on current...
I try.
Literature,
you know,
or
I come out of. That's my PhD was in German studies because I did a. It's a very roundabout story, but I spent a junior year in Munich, and so German was one of my languages that I learned, and so I did a lot of literature as part of that training, that academic training, and so for years I also taught a lot of. And in fact, at the New School, I was in for a year. I was installed as the co-chair of literary studies, and so I taught a lot of literature courses, and I still do.
Right.
And
so
that
was
and
Thomas Mann.
Exactly. Mann and Kafka and those those towering figures of the 20th
century. The
usual suspects. There you go. Exactly. You're recording.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Okay.
So
I only noticed that when you leaned in.
Noah Eisenberg, author of Will Always Have Casablanca, which is... out now, and we're going to say that.
Okay, it's out now.
When I play this, when I post this show, it will be out.
Aha, so you're going to post it on Valentine's Day or something, or sometime around then?
Yeah, the first opportunity after it comes out. So, like, if it's coming out. It's coming out what?
Tuesday the 14th, Valentine's Day.
They all
come out on Tuesdays. I had no
idea. Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, working in the music industry, we always made releases on Tuesdays. All music came out on Tuesdays.
As well. I had no idea.
Mm.
And so it lines up with Valentine's Day, which is that's the hook. You know?
Sure.
So I'm doing something at McNally-Jackson that day.
Well, one of the points of conversation is definitely is Casablanca. Romance. Is it a romance, or is it a war story, or is it about, you know, there's so many possible
D all of above. What is all it? The above.
Yeah, all the above. Or is it a redemption story slash, you know, what would it be? A story of consciousness and of doing the right thing and all.
Yeah,
certainly
it's a,
that
it's
more
a conversion
than
story as
a conversion
well.
Story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. Here's a guy who's maybe his soul, his spirit, his conscience is buried. And it's reawakened through the return of Ilsa.
And you have that great shell of complete cynicism. You know, I stick my neck out for nobody, the only cause I'm concerned with is my own all that. And
it's a front.
Yeah.
It's a front. It's his shell that he's created because his heart was broken. Yeah. So there it goes. It's behind that shell is the romantics.
Yeah. And you have that great, you know, the 8-minute flashback sequence that's really, that's where the romance is kind of buried, but then that's where it's most explicit in the flashback sequence. But throughout, it's kind of percolating beneath the surface.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from the moment that Ilsa walks into Rick's and you see Sam, the reaction shot of Sam, it's in his eyes. He knows exactly what's coming. And then once she convinces him to play as time goes by and Rick storms into the cafe and first hearing the music and then seeing him, it's that deep, deep, repressed you know, pain.
Yeah,
the love that went sour.
Right.
And if we don't tap jilted at the train station.
Yeah, if you can avoid all reminders of the person that broke your heart.
Yeah.
Just like live without even trying to any reminders at all.
It's total repression. Kind of,
yeah. Right. Yeah. How far can you you kind of repress it? So it's a Let's take a couple of steps back first, because kind of getting ahead of ourselves here. When was the first time you recall seeing Casablanca? Because I can't remember the first time
I think as a teenager, and I think with my mom.
Okay.
My mom's an enormous fan of the film, and I think as a teenager, I often, you know, they kind of, again, classic rebellious impulse. No, I'm not interested. This is, you know, what middle-aged women watch or something. And I was just wrong-headedly dismissive, pig-headedly dismissive of it.
But it's almost a natural phase, since you're mentioning it, as opposed to the more cynical response, which is it's too popular.
Yeah,
so I can't like it.
It's that as well.
Which is, it's certainly its biggest obstacle was that for today's ironic crowds, the generation of irony, that I think is where it runs into the most resistance, is this,
absolutely. No question.
Right.
And that, it's funny for someone like me, who had just a few years ago published a book on one of the least known, you know, underground filmmakers, this critical biography of Edgar G. Ulmer, who was, you know, an Austro-Hungarian emigre who came to this country and really kind of trafficked in all of these esoteric genres and sort of down market, you know, production companies and all that, to then deal with, you know, the sort of the holy grail of classical Hollywood was quite a leap.
Was that a very intimidating for you? I mean, it sounds like
I don't know. It's funny. You would think it would be, but strangely enough, given the glaring contrast between the two projects, there was almost an organic growth. And you know, the it may come as little surprise to you, but the organic growth came out of the experience of exile. And the sort of these refugees or emigres in Hollywood, and that's really where you can track the line, I think, because otherwise, Casablanca could not be more radically different and more radically removed from the kinds of, you know, B horror films and film noir and sort of, you know, in European basically unknown European low budget pictures that Ulmer was doing in the 50s. I mean, Casablanca is at the really polar opposite end of the spectrum, and yet what links them is this experience of exile and being in Hollywood, even though they were very, very different places. So Ulmer versus, say, Curtiz and all the emigre actors involved in the production. But being in Hollywood during the wartime years and being a German, or at least German-speaking emigre or refugee, as the case were, and needing somehow to come to terms with the loss of homeland and wanting to make, and this was true even for Ulmer, he did for PRC, for Producers Releasing Corporation, which is this, you know, bottom of the barrel B movie company, for which he churned out 11 pictures in 3 short years. He did some anti-war films there too, and Casablanca is, you know, there are a number of critics who've called it a terrific work of propaganda. I mean, it is really aimed at garnering greater support for the Allied war effort. And Rick's conversion narrative is all about that. It's all about that move from isolationism to active engagement, and supporting the cause, and subordinating one's own personal or libidinal urges for something much greater.
One could argue the craftiest part of this, the film, is how things are sort of, subtly gauzed over or hidden or buried a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, just a little, just enough to get by censors, to get by cynics, to get by, you know, that there's a lot going on right under the
Yeah.
Right, I mean, under this, there's a lot of subtext going on there. And so
gauze is a good word for it. Yeah. I think there is a kind of tissue of layers.
Yeah.
And because they're not always, you know, the message isn't always right there on the surface. In fact, it's often not, as you say.
Yeah.
Regarding everything from, yes, dodging the production code administration, you know, the Hays Code and Joseph Breen and his henchmen, or also I think kind of working in that war message, the need for active engagement that was clearly, I mean, that's what the Office of War Information, that's what they insisted upon. Mm-hmm. But I think that Curtiz and Hal Wallace, the producer, and those who really had a hand, and you know, some of the screenwriters as well, so the Epstein brothers and Howard Koch.
Mm-hmm.
I think in Howard Koch, even more, Epstein brothers were, you know, their wit is every funny line in the picture, I think, is really pretty much traceable back to the Epstein twins. But Howard Koch was very politically minded. And he also had a great deal of subtlety, I think, in his writing, and he managed to kind of work in those hints, you know, the hints of Rick's past, the fact that he ran guns in Ethiopia and that he fought on the side of the loyalists in Spain. Those are just those little hints that help to show, wait a second, maybe this guy's going to change. Maybe those professions of neutrality, of only being concerned with himself, those are mere, you know, that's mere rhetoric, empty rhetoric. As you have that. And as for the Epstein twins, I mean, I shouldn't discount their political engagement either, because they had, in fact, already been in Washington with Frank Capra on the production of the Why We Fight.
Why We
Fight series.
Yes.
Yeah, they'd collaborated with Capra before. Yeah,
right.
Arsenic and Old Lace, and I think there were other collaborations. Yeah. But
with Peter Lorre.
I was speaking specifically about their decision against Jack Warner's admonition to go to DC and to work on the first installment of the Why We Fight series, Prelude to War, which they then helped to write. And that was, you know, this is an award-winning documentary. It's a really, and it's a propaganda film. That's its main purpose. It was aimed at first screening to this enlisted servicemen, and to a lesser extent women at that time, but servicemen, and then to show to the broader public. And again, I mean, this was 1942, so there was still work to be done to convince people. The isolationist faction had not gone away.
Right, yeah. People often forget how late America entered into the war. So Casablanca came out while there was still war.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really bound up in that whole story. I mean, the unproduced stage play, Everybody Comes to Rick's, by Murray Burnett and Joan Allison, arrives in Burbank a day after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And so from the very beginning, it's tied
to the war.
Absolutely, absolutely. Burnett and Allison wrote their stage play, that was based on Burnett's experience, as I write in the book, and Burnett's experience of being in Europe that fateful summer of 38,
on vacation with his wife, correct?
Exactly. He was hoping for a belated honeymoon with his wife, Frances.
Got a lot more than he bargained
for. Well put. He arrives in Antwerp in the summer of 38. They're instructed to go to Vienna and to help relatives of Francis, of Murray Burnett's wife, to smuggle out precious goods. Already at that time, under Nazi rule, Jews and other refugees were forbidden, but Jews specifically, from taking out any goods. This is part of the Aryanization.
Right.
And they managed to, you know, the story that he tells, and I have to
believe it.
I was going to say, take him at his word here. Mm-hmm. His wife is wearing a fur. He's got jewels.
He's wearing the cameras. You know,
and they board this train.
Sounds like maybe they're both in fur and heels.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
not exactly.
Like a scene out of that's really wild. Like hot. Yeah. Right.
Now we're on to Some Like It Hot. We're a few years ahead of ourselves. But anyway, he gets on to that train, and they make it to France. They manage to cross the lines into what then was still free France, not yet occupied, and they get to the Mediterranean, and they go to this bar on the bluffs. This is the road to Monte Carlo on the bluffs above Nice, and at the piano is a black crooner from Chicago, and the clientele is, you know, people of all political persuasions and all backgrounds, and a babble of foreign tongues being spoken. And Murray allegedly turned to his wife on the spot and said, "This would make a great, great place for a, you know, great location for a play." Anyway, he writes that play together with Joan Allison, and it's already, I think, capturing that wartime spirit.
There's an immediacy, of course, about making a film version anyway, because it's first of all, it's fast.
Yeah,
it's it reaches more people so quickly than a play would.
Yeah, and they had trouble. I mean, they were hoping. They both come out of a strong theatrical background. Murray Burnett was an aspiring playwright. Joan Allison had already a couple plays under her belt, and was very well connected in the New York, larger sort of wider New York theater scene. And they initially were hoping. Again, this is sort of it's the old sort of highbrow intellectual investment in the theater over the movies, and I think that they shared some of that. Paul Henry talks about this in his memoir, Ladies Man, about how for him it was all about the stage. He grew up with that, you know, that was the premium. That was the gold standard was the stage. And it was really kind of selling out when you went
Paul
to the movies.
Henry,
but Paul Henry
would
play
Victor Laszlo in the film.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think that Murray Burnett and Joan Allison, they too felt, especially as New Yorkers, and coming of age at the time they did. Murray Burnett was still young. He'd only graduated from Cornell a few years earlier. He was working as a high school English teacher in Midtown Manhattan. Joan Allison was about a decade his senior, was a divorcee, had children. But for both of them, I think that the New York theater scene, that was really where they saw their future.
Well, imagine what the New York theater scene was like back then.
Yeah.
It was,
yeah,
you know, it wasn't just rehashed musicals.
No.
They were making them then.
Or successful films that then became...
As much theater as there may be today, there was probably umpteen as much. I mean, there was probably way more theater going on back then because...
I think so, and I think that if you did make a mark on Broadway, I think that the sort of the meteoric rise to celebrity status was much, much greater. I think now, in the many decades since then, we look to Hollywood for our celebrities, and especially among the writers. I mean, I think there were some playwrights in Broadway. I mean, not only working on Broadway, but working elsewhere in the wider New York theater scene, who really were household names. And I think that Murray Burnett and Joan Allison initially held hope that they too would follow that career trajectory. And when the play did not get any takers on or even off Broadway, they had their agent send it to several studios. Warner Brothers snapped it up, but it was at MGM, it was at Paramount, and there are different stories as to the response at both of those studios. But Warner Brothers, it was mainly the work of Irene Lee, who was in the head of the story department at Warner's. She was the one who really first advocated for the play and its adaptation at Warner Brothers. She's the one who went to Hal Wallace and said, "I think we've got something here." And Hal Wallace took to it really very quickly.
One of the more intriguing aspects of the book, which again is called "We'll Always Have Casablanca: The Life, Legend, and Afterlife of Hollywood's Most Beloved Movie," written by Noah Eisenberg and published by Norton Press. One of the things that I found the most interesting and intriguing in the book is more about, I think I'd heard about the differences. I'm a great listener of Karina Longworth's podcast, and so I kind of listened to that. It helped to educate me a little bit about the differences between the different studios at the time, MGM and Warner Brothers, RKO, and
she's great.
Yeah,
Hollywood history.
Yeah, she's terrific, and I recommend that podcast. Yes. I have in the past on mine.
So a plug for "You Must Remember This," which of course
that's right.
We
is
know
the name
the title.
Of the
yeah, right,
her
exactly.
podcast. Thank you for reminding me about that too. Another connection between the book and that podcast. But specifically, Warner Brothers was more outspoken. The Warner Brothers, literally the Warner Brothers, I mean, who ran Warner Brothers, the studio, were Jewish immigrants themselves, as were most of the most of the studio heads,
the vast majority.
Mm. And so they saw lots of their family members back in your parish, so they had a conviction, a strong conviction. And I found that really fascinating, that part of the book, because before, when we were talking about, you know, when I was breaking down the categories that this film could fall under romance, under you know, certainly wartime story, and but it's also a refugee story. I wanted to say that's so important. Aspect of this story, and you made reference to all the characters in the book, the main characters, as well as many of the minor characters, supporting characters of the in the film, and that's
it's a staggering figure. I think it's something along the lines of 85 of those who actually received a credit in the picture, only three of them were native born Americans.
And they
Bogart, Billy Wilson, and Joy Page.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah,
Joy Page played.
She plays Anina Brandl, the Bulgarian refugee.
Okay, she plays a refugee.
And she was of course she plays a refugee, and she was.
They're all
and
refugees.
Ironically,
of
the refugees that a number of them, of course, are stuck playing Nazis, which was a very common.
Austrian and German actors that had escaped.
Fled and voiced opposition to Nazism, arrive in Hollywood and
play Nazis and are stereotyped.
A nasty, ironic twist of history. End up
it was an opportunity to own the pain, own the, you know, it's nothing better than
Conrad Veidt specifically, who plays Major Strasser in the picture, was very, very, I think, adamant. And extremely decent, no question about that. But also was adamant about his ability to portray the insidious nature of the Nazi regime, and his embodiment of Major Strasser. I think he does it with such conviction. And this is somebody who knew it firsthand. He and his then wife, he was married to a Hungarian-born stage actor named Lily Prager, and Jewish. And they had left, and already in 1933, so just after the Nazis came to power, and they wanted Conrad Veidt, of course, to stay and work for the regime. He was asked to fill out papers, and on the papers, on the papers, he writes of his religion. He writes Yehuda. He writes Jew.
And big bold letters.
Big bold letters,
and sticking it in their face.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he wasn't Jewish, but I think that was almost like the Danish king wearing an armband. This was a moment of deep defiance and of real noble convictions, and Paul Henreid as well. I mean, these were people who were not going to stay around in Germany, even though they could have had a pretty successful career. I'd be ventured to guess had they made that choice.
Yeah.
And so they end up in Hollywood, and I mean, yes, Henreid ends up playing Victor Laszlo, so he has a very noble role to play as this leader of this great underground movement. But Conrad Veidt ends up as Major Strasser. Otto Preminger, an Austrian, Austro-Hungarian Jewish actor and famously a great Hollywood director, was brought into test for Major Strasser as well. And a lot of the minor Nazi characters in the film were played by those who fled the regime either for ethnic or political reasons, or in the case of Heinrich von Twardowski, who plays the Nazi that marches into Rick's with Yvonne on his arm late in the film, in the third act, when she comes back to Rick's, this time having turned against after being snubbed by Rick at the bar and being forced to be taken home by Sasha, she returns on the arm of a Nazi, and that's played by Twardowski, who was out already as homosexual and was therefore persecuted by the regime. And he comes to Hollywood, and what is he? He ends up playing a Nazi.
Could you come out because of there was during that brief period before Nazi Germany, there was Weimar.
The Weimar Republic.
There was
exactly.
This period of time where it was safe to.
Yes, more or less. I mean, there was paragraph 175, but yes.
I am a camera.
There was a, in the Constitution, there was paragraph 175, and that stipulated, basically it deprived homosexuals of their rights, and it was more or less in place, I guess, more than less in place during the Weimar years, and yet the Weimar years had a kind of long gasp of sort of libertine behavior and of not, I think, enforcing certain laws. And, you know, basically it was more of a sort of a don't ask, don't tell kind of situation mm-hmm. where many, many gay men and women living, especially in the cities, in particular in Berlin, I think lived a relatively happy and harmonious existence during that short-lived experiment in democracy mm-hmm. known as the Weimar Republic.
But even just, I was thinking socially, it just wasn't dangerous socially.
No.
Like they were not, never mind from the, you know, let's say the regime, but I'm talking about just even on a peer level.
Yeah, no. Like, oh, I think so. I think people were relatively accepting and open-minded.
Not happening here, but it was, in the, from what I've seen.
No, I think people have written about this. I think we're comparatively much more open-minded during the Weimar years in Germany than on these shores, for sure. But then, of course, the Nazis came to power in January of 1933, and with the implementation of the Nuremberg laws and other restrictions, the persecution of homosexuals alongside Jews and Gypsies and Roma and Sinti, as they're now known, and other political subversives. I mean, that was then, that was enforced. It wasn't. No one was turning a blind eye to that from 1933 onward.
So I think the listeners now will start getting an idea that the book is essentially giving a lot of context to the origin story of Casablanca, and from insemination from the when it was a play to when it became a film, and then its effect on the public, and its lasting effect also, and how it's still to this day, 75 years later, because this is being published on its 75th anniversary, 2017 or something.
That's right. That's our year now.
Yeah.
Hard as it may be to believe. But yes, I mean, if I could just respond briefly, as briefly as I can, as an otherwise windy academic, this was a project that enabled me to kind of draw on two facets of my background. One is a film historian, so I had the chance to kind of go through and track. And Algin Hermetz really wrote a wonderful book about the making of, and I'm enormously indebted to her and credit
her. This was in the 90s?
This was in the 92 it first came out. Mm-hmm. Roundup the Usual Suspects, this was the original title. And it was re-released that was the 50th anniversary, and then the 60th, it came out again in 2002. And she does a great job, and I follow some of her moves. One would have to. Everyone who's come after her would have to. But I wanted to account for the transition that you just described from the unproduced stage play to the screenplay to the film, and then its reception and all that went into it. Again, context, key throughout. But then the other side that I want to bring to the table is that my training in German studies and extensive research that I conducted, particularly on those refugees and emigres and exiles who suddenly were located in what was known as Weimar on the Pacific, as it came to be known during the 1940s in Hollywood of the 40s. And so... Yes, that central chapter, Such Much, which comes from the dialogue of that endearing elderly couple en route to America, that's a chapter that in many ways anchors the book for me, and I think it anchors the story. And we were talking a while ago about the subtlety of the writing, the subtlety of the different stories told on screen as well. And beneath that surface is really that refugee story. It's not always front and center. There are little glimpses that we catch of it, even when people are being rounded up in those sort of raids at the very beginning. You know, when we have it's Paul Andor who's the actor, who's the refugee who's asked for his papers and then takes off and is shot in the back.
Oh yes.
And we have Marshal Patin and then also the Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité. Anyway, the motto of the French Republic. I think I may have botched the order there.
I can fix it.
From that moment onward, you really catch these various glimpses of that refugee experience, and I wanted to spend a considerable amount of the time in the book kind of fleshing that out, because I felt that we think of this movie more than anything else as one of Hollywood's greatest romances and one of its greatest wartime dramas, but I think we often forget or just don't know about the origins of the story and all of those kind of fleeting glimpses yeah. that we catch in the film that are so fast. And Curtiz was known for his extraordinary efficiency.
Well, with the necessary time dilutes the story. Mm-hmm. We can't imagine how, I'm sure back then it didn't escape the public imagination that this was a refugee story, mm-hmm. considering that it was wartime still, and that many yeah. people were refugees and running, you know, had come to wherever safe passage. Right. It was everybody's story.
But it was also one of those things, if you think specifically of the ethnic background of many of these refugees, many of them were Jews, at least nominally so.
Sure.
Even if they didn't identify first and foremost as Jews during mm-hmm. the Weimar years, when I think many of them thought...
They became Jews when all of a sudden their lives were in danger.
Yeah, exactly.
Not because of anything bad or trying to disassociate from their Jewish background, but how many of us walk around claiming, oh, we're Jewish, when we meet somebody.
Right. And so, and in the movie, because this is a Hollywood picture from the first half of the 1940s. As Andre Aciman, one of the many dozens of people that I interviewed for this book, he's a terrific writer, novelist, critic. He says, the Jews, they're all over the screen, but not in the story, and there is that kind of implicit mm-hmm. presence, but it's not explicit. This is basically, from the time between the jazz singer and gentleman's agreement, you don't do that. Mm-hmm. You don't. And so we knew, and in fact, in the various debates and on the floors of Congress and elsewhere across the country, we knew the ethnic background of the vast majority of these refugees. Mm-hmm. And yet, in a movie like Casablanca, of course, that's not addressed. And I don't do any sort of retroactive moralistic reading of the film, and from this vantage point of 2017, how could Hollywood have been so cowardly as not to? I mean, that just wasn't done, and you couldn't. I mean, I'm not taking Warner Brothers to task. I think it was a very courageous picture to make. Period.
Yeah, and often Jews, when they were trying to be quote unquote subtle mm-hmm. about portraying Jewish characters in a lot of films, the giveaway is often kind of insulting.
Mm-hmm.
It might be in their demeanor or their maybe Semitic look or behavior of some sort, which is kind of insulting the stereotypes that are often used.
Sure.
Here you have to almost kind of give them credit because, again, while they are trying to be still trying to be subtle in this film, they give them a lot of humanity.
Absolutely.
And,
even the pickpocket, even Courtois, who plays he's called in the script the dark European, is the way he's referred to on the screenplay. But Courtois, who's the pickpocket, and there's mm-hmm. vultures everywhere.
Yes, it's.
it's a very, very small role, and he, of course, complained about it bitterly afterwards and was like so many of the previously well-known stage actors and sort of eminences mm-hmm. from Europe had real trouble finding fully developed roles. But even in this small role, he does have the humor is there, and the humanity. I mean, I think mm-hmm. there's a later exchange when he's in Rick's and he bumps into Carl Cuddles, into mm-hmm. S.E. Sakal, who was known mm-hmm. on these shores as Cuddles, the Hungarian-born cabaret actor, the jovial, jowly mm-hmm. Waiter at Rick's Cafe. He bumps into him and Carl immediately reaches for his valise, or not his whatever it would have been, his wallet in his
yes.
pocket there.
Right.
And there's a very funny moment there too. So I mean, he doesn't have a major part, but it's not vulgar.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
it's not a
caricature or uh-huh. a stereotype. Ironically, the notion of Jews as thieves, and I mean, there may be some layers deeper there, but in this case, it's a moment of levity, and that's, if we go back to Carl, the waiter, Cuddles, he too is there, and he was a great cabaret actor, mm-hmm. First in Budapest, and then in Vienna, and had been a film actor as well, in addition to appearing on the stage. A lot of his moments are there to I think, endow the film with another level of humanity, of warmth.
Mm-hmm.
It's no coincidence that he was known as Cuddles. I mean, you basically just want to go up to this guy and give him money. Of course, gives Rick that hug at the end after Rick mm-hmm. Allows Jan Brandl, the Bulgarian refugee, to put all his chips on 22, or tells him to put him on 22, and ends up winning at the roulette table. Carl, you know, is among the first to give him a hug. And then, of course, it's Sasha, the crazy Russian, who comes over and gives Rick a kiss, gives Bogey a kiss. But, I mean, these characters, these, again, if we come back to sort of just the textured, you know, the layers of these foreign-born actors, they give that film an extraordinary authenticity. Mm-hmm. And that's, I was talking to someone yesterday about this, that is one of the most remarkable accomplishments of the film, if you think about it. I mean, it's made on the sound stages of Warner Brothers in Burbank, California.
Right.
It's nowhere near this North African outpost, and yet it manages to convey a feel, a sound, a flavor of that world. And one of the ways in which it does it most effectively is by having this deep, deep cast of foreign-born actors. It was none other than Pauline Kael who said that you know, she was interviewed by Al Jean Harmetz, and she commented that she, you know, were not for these foreign-born actors, we'd really have trouble believing it.
Right.
You know, if you met, the interview, I think, was from the 80s, if I'm not mistaken, and if you were to picture then, or even today, some decades later, having these Hollywood actors play these roles, and this may be, again, this may be one they've flirted so many times of doing a sequel. Right, exactly. Yeah. I shake my head as well. Yeah. Yeah. The listeners can't see us shaking our heads, but we're shaking our heads. But one of the reasons you can't do that, I think, is because it would be very difficult to get that sense of authenticity and the timeliness.
Although the timeliness is there. You know, now you can just relocate the story to any number of places.
I would agree with you. I think that it hasn't lost any of its timeliness, the basic message of the film, and the need to do right, and the need to support those who are persecuted and who've been, you know, dealt a worse hand than you. I mean, those are all really important messages, and those are, I think, kind of core archetypes or even foundational myths, I think, of America. But I think that it hasn't lost any of its timeliness. I mean, that's a point that, again, going back to some of the interviews that I conducted, it was Leonard Maltin who spoke with me a bit about that, Lou Luminick, and then Janine Basinger, who said that the film is so much of its moment and yet also utterly timeless. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. I attribute that observation to her. It may have been one of the others as well. I mean, a number of people chimed in, and the comments that they made, I think, often looped back to that notion about the picture being so much of the moment, of, you know, America's entry into the Second World War, and yet it being completely timeless. And that's what I think accounts for our ability to watch it 75 years later and get just as much pleasure, if not more pleasure, out of it than audiences were doing from Thanksgiving Day 1942 onward.
And Bogart.
And that
just
guy.
Just Bogart. Yeah. you despise me. Don't you, Rick?
Right. Well, yeah, Laurie, even though he's in and out of the picture in the first reel, is as one of the contemporary critics from 1942-43 wrote, he leaves that indelible memory on you. I mean, you will never forget Ugarte, and you will never forget the comment that you just made when he turns to him and oh, that's right, Rick. What right do I have to think? And these sorts of this is wonderful obsequious, kind of picking up on Joel Cairo from Maltese Falcon and taking him to 11, basically. Take him, you know, Joel Cairo on steroids.
You know, Rick, watching you just now with the Deutsche Bank, one would think you've been doing this all your life.
What makes you think I haven't?
Oh, nothing. But when you first came to Casablanca, I thought...
You thought what?
What right do I have to think? Too bad about those two German couriers, wasn't it?
I got a lucky break. Yesterday, there were just two German clerks. Today, they aren't dead.
You are a very cynical person, Rick. If you forgive me for saying so.
I forgive you.
Thank you. Will you have a drink with me, please?
No.
Oh, I forgot you never drink with any... I'll have another, please.
Yes, monsieur.
You despise me, don't you?
Well, if I gave you any thought, I probably would.
But Bogey was so important, needless to say, not only for the film at its time period, but also for the revival. In 57, soon after he passed away in Cambridge, Massachusetts, at the Brattle Theater, that's really when the revivals
yeah, the
when the revivals
like
began.
It sounds like they're coming to get us.
Yeah, yeah. You know. When the revivals, exactly. I'm not sure whether that's a German, what is it, 70 B-78 bomber out there, or is that my heart pounding? I'm not sure. Anyway, but so...
Yeah,
so,
at the Brattle Theater in Cambridge, yeah, yeah. Massachusetts, programmer there. What was his name?
Well, there are two programmers, and one of whom had been a Fulbright fellow in France in the 50s. Yeah, so it's Cyrus Harvey.
Bryant.
And both Harvey and Halliday had the idea of this, what they called the Bogart Festival, that they would do.
It's a great idea.
It was a terrific idea, as it turns out. I'm not sure they were aware of it at the time, but Bogart had just recently passed, and they decided to do a festival, the cornerstone of which would be a screening of Casablanca. Mm-hmm. And the students at Harvard and Radcliffe, they developed an incredible devotion to this, to this festival that would take place each year during the reading period, reading and exam period. And so there was a lot of downtime, as the poet Honor Moore explained to me. I interviewed a number of people who were at Harvard then, and Todd Gitlin, Gene Strauss, Honor Moore. And it was Honor Moore who told me that you, or explained that you had a lot of...
I hope everybody's okay.
Yes. So during the exam, reading period and exam week at Harvard and Radcliffe in Cambridge, Massachusetts, students who were studying and studying around the clock, they had a lot of pent-up energy and were looking for some sort of release, some sort of an outlet.
This is perfect.
And the Bogart Festival that the programmers at the Brattle, they provided a forum for students to come, and come they did.
They would come
over and over again, and they would shout out the line. Some of them
it
would
was
come dressed
30
in character.
Years ago, I came to Cambridge, and I would, exactly 30 years later, or just about 30 years later, and I would remember seeing Rocky Horror Picture Show in Cambridge for the first time, and same idea.
Exactly. Same, well, that's what's interesting. It's funny. I liken it because the cult status that Casablanca has earned over the years, I think, is in strange ways analogous to... Mm-hmm. They're very, very different films, no doubt. But I mean in terms of the spectatorship. I mean in terms of going to these movies dressed in character. They're not throwing rice or you know, putting up their umbrellas. But they are shouting out lines. Mm-hmm. And there's that same kind...
Interactive.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. And that's increasingly so.
Right.
I mean, it was definitely the one of its most acute manifestations was during the 50s and 60s at Harvard and Radcliffe, and then... On the West Coast at Stanford, apparently there was a sort of offshoot, but in the meantime, you have these, you know, as recently as I think it's last year, the year before, Secret Cinema in London, where they at the Troxy Theatre, where they built a Rick's Cafe within the theater, and had not only actors who were dressed in character, but you had the spectators who purchased tickets came
in costume,
mm-hmm. and it's become increasingly interactive in that regard. I mean, I think that's known. You know, these are different, more immersive forms of cinema.
Yeah, right.
And
it seems like it's the next level of cinema in the United States is immersive cinema. Just maybe winding down a little bit.
Sure.
We're talking with Noah Eisenberg, who's the author of We'll Always Have Casablanca, which is published by Norton Press and available now where books are sold. And I recommend it. It was a lot of fun reading this book.
Thank you.
I think I probably got through it in primarily two sessions. That's how.
Wow.
And I knew I was meeting
with
you.
That's a very nice compliment. I'll take it. Thank you. I like any suggestion of page turner. I like.
It's just so much fun. I was going to ask you earlier, but I think that the how there's a sense of scholarship to it, but this is a very accessible book too. I mean, this is for any fans of cinema or the movie or Bogart or whomever your way in. So I just wanted to also mention Claude Rains is outstanding, and though we haven't brought him up, and Peter Lorre, some of my favorite actors, Sidney Greenstreet, who's not a refugee.
Though foreign born.
Right. He's British?
Was he British? Yes, he was British.
British, right?
As was Rains.
And I love his comment when he's going through the commissary and Sidney overhears some people speaking, I think Hungarian or something. And he goes, don't you know, guys, this is Hollywood. You should be speaking German.
Yeah, it's Preminger. It's Preminger.
Oh, it was
No, it's a great comic, but it's Preminger. That would be even funnier, though, from Greenstreet.
It is. Yeah.
But it was funny enough with it being a Preminger. Yeah, that's quoted in Otto Friedrich's great history of Hollywood in the 40s.
The great line.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I'm delighted that you feel that way. This was an aim, no doubt, from the very beginning, mm-hmm. of writing this book for popularized, for a non-academic audience.
It would be a misstep not to, because truthfully, this is really, even though we mentioned to Ivy League schools made this into a party, but it was really the country, I mean, speaking of America, it was the movie that brought us together. You know, I mentioned before, I also went to the Brattle quite a bit during the 80s when I was in Cambridge.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to Harvard.
Yeah, yeah, that's okay, don't worry.
I was going to another school.
Yeah,
It was during the years where they brought back, after some legal delays, they brought back Alfred Hitchcock's American films,
The
late 50s, including Vertigo, Rear Window, The Trouble with Harry, and The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Yeah, that would make sense.
I'm trying to remember. And Rope.
Has a great Peter Lorre. If you got to follow all the Peter Lorre pictures, Man Who Knew Too Much
I did. And then, of course, there was you mentioned Arsenic and Oles. No, Johnny, please, no, Johnny. Please, don't do it, Johnny.
Really fast.
What?
You're very good.
I worked on it. Way too much. I was the only 10-year-old probably who was doing Peter Lorre impressions. And
yeah, that's a good impression, though, I have to say.
Thank you. And then Elaine, I'm not a Brewster.
Not bad.
When he discovers he's...
not bad.
Yeah, that's another book.
Definitely.
They brought those back, and I watched them. And of course, Vertigo now is considered by critics alike, you know, to be the number one film when you read all the polls. Is usually now at the top with, I think, usually...
Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane, from number one spot to number two.
Yeah.
But somewhere in the top five or so, you're going to find Casablanca.
Oh, I engage in that debate a bit in the book, but it's a kind of a tedious debate.
It is a tedious debate.
In the sense that you have, of course, especially among the old cinephiles, or what today we'd simply call, I think, film geeks, you have the need, I think, to flex your muscle and to align yourself with the films that are obviously formally much more ambitious and stylistically more accomplished, more sort of virtuoso, and also, you know, kind of, reliant on the auteurist model, I think.
Sure, right.
And whether it's Hitchcock or Wells, those are two of the most towering.
Not an auteur.
Not so much.
The greatest
exception.
Studio.
To the auteur theory, Sarah said.
I was going to say Hack, but he's not.
No.
Curtiz was far from that.
But he'd be accused of that.
I think the thing is, well, as you were mentioning, yes, the Citizen Kane and, of course, any work by Hitchcock is going to always be looked at as a technical marvel on some level of all the technical prowess of these.
Right.
But what I like about the book, you're giving it more props than it's gotten. It's often not given the technical or perhaps the, I don't want to say cerebral, but I would say that there is some, just below the surface,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot more going on there, as we,
that
I think, talked about earlier today. That meets the eye, exactly, which it's not normally... I don't read a lot about that. It's a crowd pleaser.
Right.
So if you're talking about, I think that does unify the moviegoers, the average moviegoers who like maybe old movies, who like to watch old movies on the Turner Classic Movie Channel. This is the movie that is the one that comes up number one.
Yeah, 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 and for good reason. And in terms of that, I mean, look, I don't. I love Citizen Kane as much as the next cinephile, but in terms of that invidious comparison between the two, I think that Roger Ebert really did an audio commentary for the 2002 DVD release, and he says that, you know, when asked what is the greatest picture of all time, he says Citizen Kane. I'm not sure I would say that necessarily, but he says it, which is fine. I respect it. What is the film that you like most? Casablanca. And so it's that pleasure aspect that definitely distinguishes the two.
That's a cheat, by the way. It's like saying, I have to say this because I'm a critic.
Right, exactly. It is. And I don't feel...
And why choose?
I don't feel that same necessity. I really don't. I feel like I can simply say that I enjoy Casablanca tremendously without needing to fear that people will, you know, look at me with a kind of jaundiced eye, or mm-hmm. look at me as if I were a lesser film scholar and a lesser critic, simply because I have a certain soft spot for what is obviously one of Hollywood's greatest and most beloved pictures.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. We're going to devote an episode of this podcast to Casablanca, 75th anniversary, and your book, which, again, Norton Press, and available where books are sold, online or bricks
everywhere.
And mortar. Just go get a copy. Do yourself a favor. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you, Adam. I appreciate it.
It's been fun.
Great, yeah, great talking to you.
Still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes.
That's it, folks. Thanks very much. Coming up, as I think I mentioned briefly in my intro, I did sit with Barbara Koppel for the second time. This was great. I had a wonderful time with her. She was my guest on episode number 200, and as we're approaching episode 400, it would have been great to time her to be on that episode, but I want to put up this episode sooner than later. So on the next episode will be a conversation with Barbara Koppel. Now, if you're listening to this episode on Thursday night or Friday morning when I post it, I just want to mention that tonight, Friday night, the 17th of February, that Barbara will be at Metrograph, which is this wonderful theater located in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And she will be introducing her first feature, which is called, of course, Harlan County, USA, which she won the Oscar for, which is just an incredible story. If you ever get a chance, Google Barbara Koppel, you know, Oscars or Academy Award, and see the footage of her accepting her Oscar. She, by the way, was, I played this on the last episode, but she, I think it was Lillian Hellman who gave her the award. It's really incredible. And she was just such a young lady. Anyway, she's still one of my favorite guests. She's got to be in the very, very tippy top of my favorite guests ever. She is such a wonderful and supportive person, so please listen to the next episode of the podcast. And then I want to mention also coming up, speaking of great programmers, Bruce Goldstein, who is a repertory programmer at Film Forum for decades now. We're going to have an episode coming up, or a segment, I should say, with Daniel Kasman, who is with MUBI. MUBI. Been with MUBI almost from the start. We'll be playing that shortly. I've got an episode with Abel Ferrara, which I'm very excited about, and the podcasters from one of my favorite podcasts called La Grande Bouffe, and we will be having these guys on coming up soon, as well as filmmaker friend Philip Shane, and many more episodes. So keep tuning in, folks. I appreciate it. Leave us a nice message on iTunes or on our iTunes page in the form of a review and a star rating. And, of course, subscribe if you haven't done that. But if you're not on iTunes, we're also on Stitcher. We are on YouTube. It's you can find it. Just Google the show, for Pete's sake. But subscribe if you can. And keep listening to the show. Thank you very much. And we're on Facebook, as well as Instagram and Twitter. Just search and you'll find us. It's very easy. And for all your needs, feel free to visit filmwaxradio.com and shoot me a note. I do get back, maybe not right away, but I always get back. So hang in there, and thank you just for listening and for being supportive of this show I do. And we'll be back in a few days. So in the meantime, you know, really, take care of yourself and the ones you love. Broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols.